May it please the court. This case is about an unprecedented effort to exert jurisdiction over a foreign national whose connections to the United States are so attenuated that exercising jurisdiction over him would violate due process. I want to be clear at the outset that our argument is a narrow, as-applied constitutional claim based on the unique facts of this case. We do not challenge the constitutionality of MEJA, the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, on its face, and a decision in favor of Mr. Brehm will in no way hamper the government's ability to prosecute contractors, both U.S. citizens and foreign nationals, who commit crimes overseas. This case, however, is unprecedented in its lack of connection to this country, and accordingly, we ask this court to reverse the district court and dismiss the case for lack of jurisdiction. The test to apply in this case is the sufficient nexus test. And this court, in an opinion joined by Judge King, has adopted this test in an unpublished opinion, the Mohammed Omar case. It has been cited numerous times, and it follows the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit, who have concluded that, like with civil litigation and the minimum contacts test for personal jurisdiction, there is a multi-factored test to determine whether or not in a criminal case that involves extraterritorial conduct, there are sufficient connections between the individual and the conduct to justify jurisdiction. In this case, there simply are not. The district court correctly laid out these four factors in its opinion, but the court failed to address the facts of the case, the stipulated facts of the case here, to any of those factors in a meaningful and comprehensive way. Those factors are the defendant's actual contacts with the United States, including citizenship and residency. Here, the defendant is a South African citizen who had never come to the United States, set foot in the United States, or had any connection to this country. His residency was South Africa. His wife and children are in South Africa. And the victim in this case is a British citizen, likewise, without a connection to this country. Secondly, the second factor under the nexus test is the location of the acts allegedly giving rise to the offense. And here, of course, the action took place entirely outside the United States in Afghanistan. Significantly, the actions took place not on an American enclave, a federal enclave, but on a NATO-controlled airport in Kandahar, Afghanistan.
But what do you do with the fact that Brehm signed an employment contract in which he recognized that he was subject to federal civilian criminal jurisdiction?
Your Honor, he did sign an employment contract with DynCorp, and that contract gave some information about the possibility that he could be prosecuted. It did not, however, explicitly tell him that he could be covered for any activity whatsoever, including a garden variety assault that was unrelated in any way to his employment. This was, as is stipulated, a fight that occurred for one of the oldest of reasons, a romantic entanglement between two individuals who had no connection to each other based on their job, and it occurred totally outside the scope of his employment. And so there's no doubt that there was some information in the contract, but it is clear that it was neither a waiver of his rights, nor did it explicitly tell him that he could be hailed into court in the United States.
Was there some agreement between the United States and Afghanistan?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and the record is silent specifically with regard to the SOFA, which is the Status of Forces Agreement. There are, in fact, two status of forces agreements with Afghanistan, one between the United States and Afghanistan, and the other between NATO and Afghanistan. And it is clear that U.S. citizens are covered by that SOFA. In other words, that Afghanistan has allowed the United States to take care of U.S. military personnel and U.S. civilian personnel who commit crimes in Afghanistan under that SOFA. It is not at all clear whether or not that would extend to foreign national contractors. And in fact, based on the research we've done from the Congressional Research Service, and I can give the court this information if it wants, the Congressional Research Service doing a survey of SOFA agreements in Iraq and Afghanistan concluded that contractors were in fact not covered. And so to answer the question, I think that the court cannot conclude that Afghanistan gave exclusive jurisdiction over Mr. Brehm to be prosecuted as a foreign national private contractor.
Does the fact that they didn't give exclusive jurisdiction, does it end there? I mean, the question is whether or not he can be sued at all under American law.
Yes, Your Honor, and to be clear, it's whether or not he can be criminally prosecuted for what was criminal conduct directed solely at another foreign national. So this is really an unprecedented case. We have not seen any other case involving both.
But my question went to whether or not the fact that there wouldn't be exclusive jurisdiction somewhere else means that he couldn't be prosecuted as he was prosecuted. And what options would there be for him to be prosecuted?
Yes, Your Honor.
Otherwise,
to answer your question, I don't believe that the existence of jurisdiction elsewhere really is helpful in determining whether or not, as a constitutional matter, due process has been met by prosecuting him here. But the question is a natural one, and here the question is whether or not Great Britain could have prosecuted him because the victim was a citizen of Great Britain. This was a NATO base, and Great Britain is a member of NATO with forces there. The record is absolutely silent as to whether or not that was a possibility, and that would.
What if it was an American base? Would you be making this argument?
If it was an American base, the issue would be more difficult for us because clearly the United States has an interest under the protective principle and has an interest in controlling, just as it does its embassies and other foreign enclaves. Also, Section 7 of Title 18, the Special Maritime and Territorial Jurisdiction, would potentially cover that, and the government would not need to assert jurisdiction under MEJA. It is of some.
And if it was an American victim,
would you
be making this argument?
That is correct, too. In other words, if either the defendant were a U.S. citizen or the victim were a U.S. citizen, the United States would be able to make the argument that they had an interest in the outcome of this activity that is far more compelling than the circumstances here, where you have a foreign defendant, a foreign victim, and significantly, the conduct was not directed in any way towards the United States. There was no intent, which is the third factor of the nexus test that Judge Tranga did not address directly at all, the intended effect of the activities. In other words, if this was a drug importation case like Mohammed Omar, where a foreign national was trying to import heroin into the United States, absolutely the United States can exert jurisdiction.
His employer is a contractor of the Department of Defense?
DynCorp has contracts with the Department of Defense, which is why, as a statutory matter, MEJA would cover Mr. Brehm. That is separate, of course, from the constitutional question whether or not due process is violated. The fourth factor is the impact on significant U.S. interests, and this is really the factor that the government and the district court relied on, really to the exclusion of the other factors. And here, there is nothing in the record to suggest that the war in Afghanistan or even the activities of the U.S. military, the war effort on that particular day, were affected in any meaningful way. The government makes an argument that the after-the-fact response somehow should be taken into effect in determining whether or not jurisdiction should be exercised, but they have cited no case for the proposition that what one does in response to an activity can be a factor to be considered. Nonetheless.
But on the other hand, I mean, you haven't articulated a single case in which a circuit court has rejected extraterritorial application of criminal jurisdiction on due process grounds, have you?
That's correct, Your Honor. The due process cases all involve either, ultimately, U.S. citizens or U.S. victims or conduct that is directly implicating U.S. interests. For example, the efforts to bring drugs in through ships overseas, or terrorism, which is directed at American targets.
But what about the effort to maintain order on an American control base?
Well, that would be a more powerful argument if it were an American-controlled base. This was a NATO base, and certainly the argument in general that the need to maintain order and national security is an important factor, but it has to be put in the context of the facts of this case. This was a minutes-long event that happened in the heat of the moment. It was not designed to occur on that day. There's no evidence that they knew they were going to see each other. It happened outside the scope of his employment in terms of his job duties. And although it may have affected where people could walk in the airport for a number of minutes, it in no way endangered or sufficiently affected the security of the base or of the war effort so as to justify jurisdiction.
Well, it had to affect the security of the base. People going to run around there stabbing each other.
Your Honor, certainly for the moments that it occurred, it affected the security of the base. But this is a multi-factored test. And in the civil context, we see that foreign corporations are given potentially more protection than criminal defendants who have a less significant relationship to the United States. There are many cases, including cases from this court, including Ellicott Machine, in which there are significant contacts between foreign corporations and a particular jurisdiction, phone calls, even physical visits, multiple contracts signed, but where the court concludes.
I hate to interrupt you.
That's okay.
Let me ask you a question. Why was he taken into custody by United States military personnel?
It's an excellent question, Your Honor, and the record does not reflect why that occurred rather than Dutch military or British military. What we do know from the record is that this is a NATO-controlled base, that there were 15,000 American soldiers. They represented approximately 80% of the military forces in the area at the time. We know that there are other countries who are members of NATO who control.
Did U.S. military run the base?
Your Honor, the record is not clear as to who the commanding general was. There's absolutely, I think, no basis upon which to infer or conclude that the United States had sole or even primary control of security. I will say this, that he was apprehended by a CID agent who was a U.S. soldier who simply happened to be walking down that corridor. So it wasn't that it was being patrolled at that moment by a criminal investigator. So whether it was happenstance.
Was evacuated to a U.S. military hospital, was he not, ultimately?
He was. And again, this comes back to the after the fact. What weight can be given to the fact that the United States devoted resources to reacting to something? We suggest that there must be a limiting principle. Due process must have an outer boundary, and that this is a case in which that outer boundary has been crossed, where you have a foreign national engaged in a real garden variety fight that is motivated purely by personal reasons against a foreign national that has at most only an incidental effect on the running of an enormous airport used by multiple nations that is not under the exclusive control of the United States, that boundary has been crossed. And I would note that the government itself recognized this when MEJA was passed. MEJA was passed, and there's a lot of discussion in the government's brief about the policy reasons behind MEJA, trying to fill this gap in the law that there were American dependents and contractors associated with the military who were committing crimes against other American citizens, often, sadly, sexual assault by a step-parent of a child in Japan or in Germany, and that the host countries were not prosecuting those cases because they did not see, with an American perpetrator and an American victim, a deep interest in prosecuting those cases. MEJA was designed to cover that gap. MEJA does cover that gap. There is no due process claim in those cases with American citizens and American victims. Neither is there a jurisdictional gap with regard to foreign nationals who are working for American contractors and who, in the scope of their work, do something that affects directly American interests. Here, those interests are so attenuated that due process is violated, and the Deputy General Counsel of the Department of Defense submitted a letter suggesting that there could be situations exactly like this, and we suggest that this is such a case, and we would ask the court on the facts of this case to find that due process has been violated.
You got this case up here by making a conditional plea and then taking an appeal?
We did, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Let's hear.
Thank you.
What the government's got to say.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Michael Rotker from the Department of Justice on behalf of the United States. As my colleague has framed the issue this morning, the question that he is focused on is whether there's a sufficient nexus to justify the exercise of jurisdiction, the district court's assertion of jurisdiction. I'd like to just make a preliminary point, and then I'll turn to the substantive merits. The preliminary point, as I think everybody agrees, there is no binding precedent in this circuit requiring a nexus. The case was litigated on the basis of Mohamed Omar, which is an unpublished and hence non-precedential decision. We would simply suggest that because the case was litigated on that basis, and because we believe the court can and should uphold the district court's finding of a nexus, the court can simply assume arguendo that a nexus is in fact required, that there's no need for the court to definitively pronounce on that issue in order to decide this case. And I think that approach is consistent with general principles of restraint. The court doesn't need to reach out to decide that question. As far as the substantive analysis, I think largely there's agreement about the proper standard. The question is, did the district court misapply the relevant factors here? And I think if the court looks at the district court opinion, specifically JA 176 to 178, I think the way the district court told the story in terms of how it analyzed the factors gets it exactly right. And let's start at the beginning. Mr. Bream decided of his own volition to take a job with a U.S. military contractor. And his status as an employee of that contractor is not now and has never been in dispute. And in fact, as my opponent rightly observed, that's the reason that he was subject to prosecution under MEJA. That's the tie that made the statute applicable. But that employment status is also critical to the due process analysis here. And what the district court explained, and again, JA 176, and it also refers to the joint statement of undisputed facts at JA 125. As a result of accepting that job, Mr. Bream received a number of privileges, benefits, and services that were provided to him by the United States. When he took the job, the Department of Defense sent a letter of authorization. This is a JA 125. It's attached to the statement of undisputed facts. And as the district court noted, in that letter of authorization, Mr. Bream received a number of government-furnished services. He received transportation, meals, access to military banking, something that says military-issued equipment, other access to government-furnished services in this case. That is certainly a factor that's relevant to a nexus inquiry. Another point the district court made, and this is very important, is that the DOD letter of authorization is what gave Mr. Bream specific physical access to the airfield to begin with. It's a restricted area. That letter of authorization, because he worked there, gave him access to the airfield. And why is that so critical? It's critical because that was the site by where the crime was actually committed. So without the authorization, without the employment status, he would not have had access to the airfield. And that's a critical fact. The other point that the district court emphasized is to look at the actual effects that Mr. Bream's conduct had on the United States and the United States' interests. Now, I heard my colleague say this morning, well, what weight should be given to those, what he called, I think, after-the-fact effects? We suggest the court can give significant weight to those facts, just like the district court did. And I want to walk through what the facts are, and then I want to explain why the intent standard that he's proposing is simply incorrect. The facts, as Your Honor, Judge Duncan has identified, as the district court identified, he disrupted the peace and the security at the airfield. Number two, there was a psychological effect on the morale at the airfield. Number three, his actions required the deployment, of significant deployment, of resources to both stop the threat and to treat the victim, and also to detain him pending his return to the United States. Those are all adverse effects, none of which are disputed. The actual effects are not in dispute in this case. What is being disputed is the legal significance. And what I've heard my colleague say, and what I think his brief is trying to point out, is that that's irrelevant because he didn't act with any intent. The stabbing wasn't motivated by an intent to affect U.S. interests. That may be true. We're not disputing that fact. We haven't. But it misses the point. It confuses a sufficient condition for satisfying the nexus with a necessary condition. The prior cases, and Mohamed Omar is the same example I was going to use, importing drugs. You have a foreign crime that's hatched overseas. The defendant has the intent to affect United States interests, and the courts have said that's fine. They're not saying that's the only way to prove the requisite nexus. They're saying that is one reasonable way. It's a sufficient condition. In this case, we're not relying on Mr. Brehm's intent because it's not a fact that's present here. But that doesn't mean the court has to turn a blind eye or the district court had to turn a blind eye to the actual effects. And in many respects, I think this is actually a stronger case for why jurisdiction exists. We're not just looking about what the intended effect was. We have actual effects on a complete record. Based on undisputed facts, the parties put before the district court, you can take into account those effects. There's nothing that prohibits consideration of actual effects. And that's why I think in some ways it's a stronger case. It's not the intended effects. You can look at a concrete record and see that the United States and its interests were harmed by this conduct. Now, the fact that it's a personal crime, that it's motivated, the subjective motivation of the actor doesn't take away from what the actual impact was on the United States' interests.
Allow the government to create the jurisdiction if it wants to.
I don't think we're creating jurisdiction. I think we're applying legal standards to the context of a particular case.
But you're saying if the facts turn out that the government was involved and the government did this and the government did that, well, the government could just decide, we want to get this guy. We want him in our control. So let's be the ones to tend him. Let's be the ones to arrest him. Let's be the one to put him in a cell.
Well,
and they can, buying your argument, let them create the jurisdiction, even though it may even be contrary to the intent or knowledge of the defendant.
I mean, with respect, Your Honor, I think that prosecutors and the government actors in general should be entitled to a presumption of good faith and regularity. There's certainly been no evidence in this case that the government was attempting to manufacture jurisdiction. We took the facts as we found them. Okay, we're not trying to claim that he was actually intending to harm a U.S. citizen. We're not trying to make up facts that the record doesn't support. This case was litigated below, as Your Honor noted, on a conditional plea. There was a joint statement of undisputed facts. Now, it is an undisputed fact that he had access to the base because the DOD gave him a letter. It's an undisputed fact that he accepted, as part of his employment contract, these government-furnished services.
What's the significance of the fact that it was apparently a NATO base?
Well, I think my opponent gave the correct answer. If this was a U.S. airfield, we wouldn't be under the MEJA statute. This would fall under 18 U.S.C. 7 because it would be special maritime jurisdiction. So the significance of it there, I don't know. I'm not familiar with whether there are due process cases under 18 U.S.C. 7. But the reason...
In Afghanistan, are there separate bases and entities that are strictly American, or is everything NATO?
No, I assume there are. I mean, Bagram Air...
No.
I don't know for...
The record doesn't show.
The record may speak to Bagram, which I believe is a U.S. airfield, and I think the record does speak to that issue, but I don't think in general. I think what the record shows is that Kandahar is a NATO airbase, and I believe there are discussions that Bagram is a U.S. airfield. That's the extent to which the record speaks to the issue. So I don't think there are any cases that preclude the court at looking at the actual effects. Now, I also want to...
Should we be looking at what actually happened, or should we be looking at what the defendant reasonably should have expected?
Well, I think that's part and parcel. I think the defendant's expectation, and that actually segues nicely to the next point that I wanted to make, which is the employment contract. As the district court also found, after it listed all those actual effects, the district court said, and I do want to quote the point, nor should Mr. Brehm be surprised by this court's assertion of jurisdiction over him. And of course, the lack of surprise is from the employment contract. Now, Mr. Brehm voluntarily signed that contract, and again, there doesn't appear to be any dispute. It's in the undisputed facts, and there's no dispute this morning, that the language of the contract said that he may be subject to U.S. federal civilian criminal jurisdiction under the MEJA. So in terms of what he reasonably should have expected, I think he's put on notice right then and there. Now, the interesting thing—
Mr. Notmanoff says that he didn't have reason to believe that his conduct would fall under MEJA.
Right. Well, certainly the conduct, I mean, he's conceded that the conduct falls under MEJA. What I understood him to be arguing, Your Honor, is that he didn't have specific notice.
Over him.
Correct.
Right.
And I think, actually, that he's getting it, with all due respect, it gets it exactly backwards. The language of the employment contract is very broad. There's nothing in there that limits it or suggests in any way that he shouldn't have known that the MEJA wouldn't have applied to his criminal conduct. I mean, he's saying, well, it says it may be subject to it, and it's not clear whether personal disputes... That, I think, misses the point. He gets it exactly backwards. There's nothing in there that gave him a reasonable expectation that personal disputes were somehow carved out. This is broadly worded, and the district court found that he signed that contract, he understood, the terms of it are, that he understands, he accepts, and he's informed that he may be subject to a criminal prosecution. We're not saying that that's dispositive, but in terms of the expectations, in terms of what's reasonable, in terms of what's fair, in terms of notice. Because again, after all, the due process nexus test, yes, it's nexus, but let's step back. What is due process all about? It's about, in the criminal context, it's about fair warning and notice. And certainly, the fact that he voluntarily signed that contract and was on notice that the media might be applicable to him, I think that's a significant factor. The district court certainly gave it weight, and there's no error in the district court relying upon that factor in the circumstances of this case. If the court has no further questions on the due process point, we would simply say that, let me just make one final point. It's been suggested this is an unprecedented case, and in a literal sense of the word, that's true. Because the facts haven't arisen, this is the first time a court is confronting that scenario. But just because it's unprecedented doesn't mean it's difficult, and doesn't mean that the government somehow exceeded its grasp in the circumstances of this case. There are enough ties and enough connections to the United States and United States interest to make this prosecution reasonable. And again, keeping in mind, the purpose of the media was to close this gap. And although he's not saying so explicitly, Mr. Bream's argument, if you accept it, is really going to immunize him from a prosecution. And it's going to de facto have the effect of creating the same kind of jurisdictional gap that media was designed to close in the first place. I mean, if you're going to say that there's certain, you know, certainly if we had a case with an American victim or something like that, it would be stronger. That doesn't mean the facts of this case take it outside the realm of what's reasonable. And so we would urge the court to affirm Judge Tringa's decision.
Judge Traxler's question, how did the U.S. military get custody of him?
I again agree with my distinguished colleague here that there's nothing in the record that speaks to. There was a CID agent who was physically, I believe, deplaning or was at the scene at the exact moment, and he effectuated the rest. In terms of how the decision was made as to who should hold him, I don't believe the record speaks to that issue. If the court has no additional questions, I'd be happy to cede back the balance of my time, and we'd urge the court to affirm the judgment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I can make a couple of points. The nexus test and the civil minimum contacts tests and the other tests that have been adopted by other circuits really come down to three fundamental issues with regard to the exercise of due process in an extraterritorial circumstance. And they are people, place, and conduct. In other words, the court looks at who are the people, who are the actors involved. And here that factor weighs entirely in favor of Mr. Brehm. He is a South African citizen with no connection to this country. The victim in this case was a British national.
Well, he did have a connection with this country. He had an employment contract.
He did, and Your Honor, to the extent that there was an issue with regard to his employment, we would not be arguing that that would not necessarily give rise to jurisdiction here.
You said that there was no connection with this country, and there was a connection. Now, you're taking it a step beyond to say that the connection, that the jurisdiction depends on the nature of the connection to the action. That's a step. That's a further step.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think there are good parallels in the civil context, which is where you see that foreign corporations do have some interaction with the forum. Here, Mr. Brehm had an employment contract with DynCorp that is based in Virginia. Had there been a dispute over his payment, had he wanted to sue DynCorp, or had DynCorp wanted to sue him, arising out of that contract, potentially that's something for which jurisdiction should have been exercised. But when you look at the exercise of jurisdiction in the criminal context, you have to look at all three of these factors, I would submit. And that's what the nexus test goes to, as well as the minimum context test. And when you look at his connections, however tenuous they may be, or the employment contract.
What role does the minimum context test play here?
Well, in Mohammed Omar and in other cases, the cases looking at the exercise of criminal jurisdiction have said that the nexus test really serves the same function. We're not saying that all of that law is imported, but like other principles of law that have applicability in the civil and the criminal context, we cite the example of collateral estoppel. Certainly, the court can use it as guidance, and I think fundamentally it's not so much the factors as the issues here. Are the people, the place, and the conduct sufficiently related to justify exercising jurisdiction? And if I can just make one or two points about this issue of intended effect. The issue of intended effect is important. It is one of the four factors. And I think I heard my distinguished colleague say that he agrees, and I think the record is clear, that there is just zero evidence that there was an intention on the part of Mr. Brehm to affect any U.S. interest. Now, the issue about the after-the-fact responses goes to not the intended effect, but the impact, whether there was an impact and what that impact was. And I think that the reason we feel strongly that this is a case in which the court should reverse and find that due process has been violated is that this is a case where, if the government's argument is accepted, there truly is no limiting principle, because these facts are so far on the outer boundaries. And that does explain why this is an unprecedented case. The cases that we've seen, and we've seen a lot of them in the Eastern District of Virginia, overwhelmingly involve either U.S. citizens or conduct that directly implicated U.S. interests.
When you say consider impact, tell me what you believe are the factors we would consider in determining impact. Impact on United States interests.
Sure.
How would we evaluate that?
The factor actually talks about not just impact on U.S. interests, but impact on significant U.S. interests. And here, I think, we can see examples elsewhere, like the Campbell case, where a foreign national demanded kickbacks in exchange for giving bribes. Clearly, there's an impact on the United States when his mission was to distribute money for USAID, and he demanded kickbacks. It affected directly the reputation of the United States. It affected the mission of USAID in doing that. Mr. Brehm was a travel coordinator for DynCorp. He was not on a mission to support U.S. troops in the field. I'm not in any way saying that what he was doing was unimportant, but this event in no way affected his...
Everybody that's over there is supporting our effort there, aren't they?
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but under that...
We got a contract with them to support us.
That's correct, but under that argument, absolutely any act taken at any time by somebody affiliated with a contractor would be subject to jurisdiction here. I think that would implicate the notion of a general police power overseas. The federal government doesn't have a general police power within this, and I see my time is almost up. If I could just finish, Your Honor. If Mr. Brehm and the victim here had come to the United States and had this fight at Disney World for the same reason, the federal government could not have exercised jurisdiction over him. This was an ordinary garden variety fight. And so there's something ironic about the notion that two foreign nationals who have this fight overseas on a NATO base could be subject and found to have sufficient connection with this country. And for that reason, we ask you to reverse the district court and dismiss the case for lack of jurisdiction. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to keep going. I'd rather have a quick break. Okay. We'll come down and greet counsel, take a short recess.
This honorable court will take a brief recess.